from his own. "And you let me carry that the whole time we—" He raised an eyebrow at her. Kate squeezed her knees tighter and caused his ribs to creak. "Anderson Cross, you are a class A, finest grade, top of the heap, jerk." He laughed again, and she rolled off to lie beside him. "Because you're such a jerk, you get to be the one to go to the galley and retrieve the bottle of champagne I hid there." He stood, stretched, and walked to the door without risking another look at her.
"Yes, ma'am, Commander Red Ma'am," he crooned.
He almost escaped clean when the thrown boot hit him in the back of the head. He stumbled the rest of the way into the corridor and gave an involuntary "ow" as the door slid shut behind him. With a broad smile, he wandered off to find the galley. Chapter 12. The meeting room on the Pandora featured displays that masqueraded as windows covering the entirety of one wall. Standing before them, Kate saw the remarkable colorscape of the gravity wave they traveled in, and shook her head in amazement at the changes in her reality over the last 17 months, over all of their realities. She sighed and tore herself away from the view, then turned and took the chair at the apex of the table. Her officers were seated around the oval surface, looking very uniform in their matching tunics and pants. Kate had selected a dark blue tunic to differentiate the Pandora's outfits from the dress blacks of the UAL Navy. Aside from the color, they followed the traditions, right down to the stylized logo they'd adopted for the Pandora, penned at the top of each sleeve. She took a deep breath, letting her senses fill with the quiet hum of her vessel, then blew it out. "Everything running properly?" she asked. Her team answered in the affirmative, or nodded, or, in the case of her engineer, Trey Winstell, gave her the sign language symbol for okay. She grinned, the stress of the situation pushed aside for just a moment by the abundant energy and dedication of her crew. "Pandora, would you explain what we're doing?" The ship's avatar materialized next to the main display screen, and Kate quickly stifled a grin. She'd abandoned her normal flowing dress in favor of a more martial cut, featuring Kate's chosen color scheme. In addition, the logo appeared high on one shoulder. It was heartwarming, and a quick look at the faces of her crew signaled they felt it too.
"Commander Flynn, assembled officers, we are en route to the nearest Domeki base. I've asked Commander Flynn to do this for three reasons."
Behind her, a schematic showing the installation and their proximity to it in the context of the larger war effort filled.
"First, I'm running low on a number of fundamental components used for manufacturing, including proteins, metals, and certain items I cannot build myself, but are required elements for other assemblies."
Kate knew there was a section of the ship which the humans weren't permitted access for safety reasons. It was in this location that the manufacturing functions resided. She had an almost desperate curiosity to see what was within, but considered remaining in ignorance a small sacrifice for the partnership she'd built with the sentient vessel.
"Second, it's my hope we'll find advanced weaponry or schematics for advanced weaponry there. Information taken at the last base suggests that activity continued for some time after I went dormant. There may be items useful to the war effort there."
Kate nodded, as did many of her crew. Beyond the short-term value of weapon stockpile, she couldn't fault the ship for wanting to learn and grow.
"Finally, it's imperative we discover the state of the Domeki. Our experience at the last base left us uncertain of their status, whether sleeping or waking, and such a mystery cannot remain unaddressed."
"Thank you, Pandora." She turned to her team. "Any questions?"
"Why the sudden urgency?" asked Santiago Diaz. "Could we not have undertaken this quest at some other moment during the last several months? Why does it need to happen at a time of crisis, with our colonies under attack?"
"Lieutenant Diaz," replied the Pandora, "it's a combination of factors. First, the revelation our enemy is now using new types of weaponry they haven't previously deployed against you. Second, our proximity to the base is as near as it's likely to be. Finally, I seek.
She paused in a way that Kate interpreted as a shrug.
Reassurance about the activities of the Domeki.
Kate's eyes widened at the last.
I have an additional reason, she said. Right now, we're not essential to the effort to defend the colonies. The AAN has detailed 2 ships to fill in for us that would have otherwise been part of the group waiting at the staging point. If we return with new weaponry, we can be much more effective in the final engagement.
Lieutenant Wickrens, perhaps the most hot-headed member of her crew, bristled as she spoke, and Kate waited for an outburst. When one didn't come, she asked,
Sean, you have something you'd like to say?
He growled the words as if in a battle with them.
If our very reason for serving in the Navy isn't to protect our people, then I find myself wondering what it is, Commander.
The faces around the table radiated concern, confrontation, and, on at least one face, sympathy for the question.
Reasonable people may disagree, Sean. Our Admiralty and our captains are united in their belief that humanity is best served by not losing focus on our ultimate goal of cutting off the head of the enemy. It's acceptable for you, for every one of you, to agree or disagree with that strategy to any extent you like.
Kate's voice hardened, and she put her palms down on the table and moved her stare systematically around the table.
However, while you may feel as you will, you must, nonetheless, follow orders. We are sailors in the UAL Navy. When the time for discussion is at hand, all voices are welcome. But now that the decision's been made, in this case by me as the commander of the ship, it's up to you to do your best to see that through.
She knew she'd probably hadn't needed to say it. Her crew would follow her without fail. But a reminder never hurts. Kate softened her tone.
I believe we can do this quickly enough to join those defending the colonies.
Jele Kazia asked,
Do we think the Domeki will be sleeping?
That's our best assessment, Lieutenant Kazia.
Pandora changed the display to show a representation of the Domeki installation they traveled toward.
Long-range sensors indicate that the base is at a higher level of activity than the last, but this is based solely upon power fluctuations emanating outward. This may be automatic, or it may be part of a wake-up cycle, or it may be something that doesn't exist in my records. There's no way to tell without investigating.
Pandora, do you believe we have a cause for concern over the status of the Domeki?
Again, that pregnant pause before the reply.
Commander Flynn, it would be unwise to speculate. There's no knowing the status, and there's no knowing any other factors that may be related to that status. Hence, the need to investigate.
Kate felt a shiver shoot down her spine, something in her hind brain finding Pandora's words less than reassuring. She shivered once to clear the sensation instead.
All right, we have 3 hours until reversion. Catch a nap, grab a snack, and get ready to go once we come out.
The ship emerged at the appointed time, and well-tried procedures required a scan of the system for dangers. None were found.
I've negotiated basic access to the base, Commander. We may dock in a hangar if we wish.
Kate frowned.
I don't like the idea of being trapped inside if something goes wrong. Find an external hatch and let's do a grapnel over. We can use it as a guide in transit with our suit jets.
She unbuckled and headed for the bridge exit.
Peterson, you have the con.
Aye,
she responded. Kate found the rest of her crew suiting up in the armory and slipped into her own alcove. The ship's robot arms attached the exoskeleton, then fastened the armor plates to it. She'd requested an augmentation to her suit, and an extra computer interface module had been installed to allow Pandora to take a direct feed from the helmet, even in situations where she might otherwise be prevented from doing so. They hadn't had the opportunity to test it out yet, but they were both hopeful it would prevent loss of communication and permit greater assistance from the ship during their excursions. When the final bolt spun into place, Kate stepped free of the alcove and marched to the wall of weapons. She chose two sidearms and a rifle, locking them into the appropriate spots on her armor. She fashioned a first aid satchel to her calf and retrieved a bandolier of grenades, which she snapped around her waist.
"Connection established," reported the AI in her suit, followed shortly by Pandora's much more human-sounding voice saying,
"Confirmed."
"Let's move it, people," Kate said, and the team clomped out of the armory and into the boarding airlock. She checked her display as the air was expelled from the room, noting that everyone had properly sealed their suits and switched to internal oxygen. Likely it had been done for them without their involvement. A rush of warmth flowed through her in appreciation of the sophistication of the Domeki technology and her luck in possessing it. The hatch opened, and she saw a line that stretched from above it to terminate above an open portal on the base.
"Kazaya first, then Diaz, then me."
They lined up in order, and the rest of the team fell in according to their preference. Kazaya pulled a connector from her suit, attached to a thin line, and attached it to the guide. With a shouted,
"Wahoo!"
she leapt from the ship and triggered her jets to shoot across the short distance. When she was halfway across, Diaz followed with an absence of fanfare, and Kate launched herself just as Kazaya entered the installation.
"No hostiles. Room is plenty big for all of us. One exit. I have it covered."
Jela Kazaya was the epitome of no-nonsense when on a mission.
"Everybody into the pool," Kate ordered.
Less than a minute later, her team had made the transit, and the hatch closed behind them. As the pressure in the airlock equalized, they deployed into a semicircular defensive position around the door. On a signal from Pandora, the portal slid open.
"I have access to most of the systems through our connection, Commander Flynn," she said. "However, I don't have access to internal security features, such as cameras or motion sensors yet."
"Affirmative,"
Kate replied. She called up a schematic of the base to use as a map, with routes already drawn to take the team to three important locations: the sleeping chamber, the storage area, and the command center.
"Since time is of the essence, we'll split up," she said. "Winstell and I will head to the control room, Kazaya and Wickrens to the bedroom, Diaz and LaChance to the stockpile."
They took off at a run, headed for their disparate objectives. As Pandora continued to detect no sign of activity, they abandoned the leapfrog and cover approach and opted for speed in its place. The team detailed to the storage area was the first to arrive.
"We're in, Commander," reported Diaz. "Feeding details back to Pandora now."
"Excellent," she said. "As soon as you know what's needed, get it over to the ship."
"Affirmative,"
he replied and clicked off. Kate and Winstell entered the control center to find the lights up and every display illuminated.
"That's different," she said.
She headed to a display on the outer perimeter while her counterpart moved toward the one in the middle. She reviewed the information on the screen, which blurred and then dissolved into a translated version, courtesy of the suit's computer.
"I can't understand what I'm seeing here. It certainly looks like activity. Maybe code of some kind."
Even with the translation, what she was looking at was gibberish.
"That's a programming terminal," said Pandora. "There are no clear equivalents in your language to that language, which is why your suit cannot translate it in a useful way."
Kate sighed and ran a hand across it, thinking how enjoyable it would be to spend some time here learning all that the room had to teach. The moment was broken by Winstell shouting,
"Got it!"
She turned to see a familiar disc on top of the display he was working on, with cables extending out of it and disappearing into the unit.
"Is that what I think it is?"
"Yep, another one of the sub-Pandoras. She constructed some against the possibilities that the connection through your gear wouldn't be adequate,"
Pandora chimed in.
"In this case, Commander, it's simply downloading information for later analysis, but much faster than we'd be able to otherwise."
Kate frowned.
An excellent plan. But in the future, please clear things like this with me first, you two.
Indeed, Commander, replied Pandora.
Aye, followed Winstell, his enthusiasm clearly dampened. She shook her head in fond memory of the times in her career when she wasn't a buzzkill. They were fewer than she'd prefer.
We've made it to the sleeping area, said Wickerns. I don't want to alarm anybody, but all the pods are open and empty.
Pandora,
is there additional information to be gained from the chamber?
Negative, Commander.
Okay, you two help get the supplies out of here. We'll be along as soon as the data download is done.
Affirmative, Commander.
Kate turned to Wickerns, who gave her a palms-up gesture. She didn't know either, but she didn't think the abandoned pods boded well. They exited the base shortly thereafter, replenishment complete, and the ship again secure. As she made her way toward the armory, she asked,
What have you discovered, Pandora?
There were no advanced munitions or schematics among the supplies, Commander. Only the basic elements I needed. The inhabitants appear to have received a signal and sent a signal. I can only assume the first was an instruction to awaken, and the second a confirmation of their status.
What does that mean for us?
Uncertain, Commander. However, included among the data downloaded was the location of another depot, one used for the storage of weapons instead of storage of ships.
The urgent desire to investigate the base was obvious in her words and tone. Kate hated to disappoint her ship, but had no choice.
We'll make it our first priority after we do our duty and assist the colonies.
Yes, Commander Flynn.
Kate noted an edge of frost in Pandora's reply.
All right, Pandora, get us underway. The sooner we're done saving the colonists, the sooner we'll be able to visit the depot.
She clomped into the arming room to discard her gear and grab a few precious hours of sleep before the next crisis appeared. Chapter 13. When the breaching charges that were stacked from the base to the top of the wall exploded as one, it was a sight to behold. Indrat Vray stood with her hands on armored hips as a broad section of the barrier disintegrated. Inside her helmet, she smiled wide.
Advance!
Shouted the commander of her ground forces, and Droshin soldiers streamed into the gap, firing as they went. Her suit pickups transmitted the screams of the defenders, the cracks of projectile weapons, and the sizzle of old-style energy weapons. She drew her rifle from its carry position on her back and followed her troops through the fissures in the wall. Indrat caught movement to the right and twisted into a crouch, the targeting reticule in her helmet locked onto a colonist that was mostly concealed behind a low barricade and was pointing a long-barreled weapon at her. She raised her rifle until its firing reticule overlapped the other perfectly in her display and squeezed the trigger. A thin blast of energy connected her to the colonist in a brief moment before his rifle, the arm holding it, and part of his shoulder burned away. He fell with a scream, and Indrat scanned the field for another target. Her troops were spreading out in all directions, smashing in the doors of the pitiful structures the humans had created on this planet, and eliminating any foes found inside. The constant reports of,
Go! Contact! And clear!
That sounded in her helmet tracked their progress. Soon, that progress slowed, then stopped. One of her officers ran to stand before her.
Fleet Captain, we've rounded up what remains of the people of this colony. Their leader is asking to speak to you.
Indrat grunted in acknowledgement and walked slowly through the tattered compound. Despite her frustration with them and her complete confidence the gods had called for their deaths, she couldn't bring herself to feel strongly one way or another for the humans in the colony they destroyed. They were the martial equivalent of livestock, useless in battle and a distraction to the war effort for both sides. Were it not a holy war they undertook, she'd find the assaults on these irrelevant settlements dishonorable. As it was, she found them distasteful, repetitive, and unfulfilling. By the time she reached the last bastion of humanity on the planet, her armor was caked with the infernal dirt and dust that made up the surface of the rock. It left her with the deep desire for an eights-long shower. Before her stood a grouping of humans, women, children, and those too decrepit to hold a weapon. One of the latter, an old man who walked with the twisted stagger of some infirmity, approached her. He stopped and composed himself. Then he asked,
"Are you the one called Indrat?"
She triggered her external speakers.
"I am."
"Your name is known among the colonists. It's known as one to be feared, but it's also one that's spoken of with respect."
"Go on."
"It's been said that you have, in the past, allowed at least the possibility of existence for the women and children of the colonies you've attacked."
"Go on."
She could see that her emotionless responses increased the human's fear. Were he not cattle, she might even care.
"I'll offer you whatever you desire, including my own life, if you'll only show mercy to these young ones and those guardians necessary to give them a chance at survival. Just a chance."
He finished with a sob and a crack in his voice. He looked away from her while he marshaled his emotions. She waited. Finally, he lifted his gaze again and stood tall, the tracks of his tears creating caverns in the dirt on his face.
"Acceptable," she said,
and quick drew her customized projectile sidearm. The pistol barked. The human's head was exploded by the bullet's impact and subsequent detonation, and the weapon was smoothly returned to its holster as the finish of one continuous circular motion. Before his body had come to rest on the filthy crust of the planet, she was already searching for the commander of her ground forces. She heard, distantly, at the edge of her focus, her first officer corralling the humans and informing the rest of the Zhoshin forces they were to be permitted to live. To live for as long as they could manage on this desolate rock. She wasn't sure it was truly mercy, but she'd given her word. Indrat found her quarry in the main building of the colony, his helmet sitting on the desk before him as he rifled through papers. Beside him, a technician worked at the antiquated computer system. She removed her own helmet and set it aside.
"It's the damned dust fleet, Captain. It has fouled the helmet's optics enough to be a hindrance."
He gestured at the mess of hard copy documents around him.
"What kind of species still keeps physical records on a colony?"
He shook his head.
"Perhaps that's why there are so few native trees and plants,"
Indrat mused.
"They turned them into paper."
"Idiots,"
he replied.
"What have you found?"
She pulled her skull feathers free from the cord that bound them and gave them a shake. It was a breach of protocol that would no doubt scandalize the technician trying to ignore them.
"In these documents, nothing of value. Records of visits from ships of the fleet, records of births and deaths, records of how many bullets left in the armory."
He threw the papers away from him in disgust.
"These fools needed to spend more time building up their defenses or their existence rather than counting and recounting and recording things. On God's damned paper!"
He bit off the final words as if the act of speaking them would somehow murder the offenders.
"Different beings, different priorities,"
Indrat said dismissively, and turned to the other person in the room.
"What have you discovered?"
"The communication we intercepted with the new security protocols allowed for easy entry into their systems, Fleet Captain. They, too, are entirely unsophisticated and filled with unimportant information."
He looked up, saw her scowl, and cleared his throat.
"However, we do have a message from the fleet that we have no record of previously intercepting. It sets this colony's priority in the overall defense, tells them to do their best to hold on, and informs them the response force is on the way."
Indrat went still for a moment, contemplating the word choice in the message. Either the humans were endeavoring to give their colonists false hope, or the fleet had chosen an unanticipated response. Before she could speak again, the comm unit in her ear came alive with the voice of her second aboard the Ruby Rain.
"Fleet Captain, our drones near the system entry have picked up human vessels."
She retrieved her helmet and locked it into place, then replied,
"Show me."
A schematic of the system drew itself on her display, and then icons for enemy vessels popped into view. 8 ships, equal to her number on the planet. However, 4 of hers were lightly armed troop transports. She triggered the channel that would connect her to all the Trojan forces on the planet.
"We have enemies arriving in the system. Grab anything you think might be useful and return to your ships, immediately. We lift off as soon as the cruisers have the minimal crew to do so. If you're not on board, you'll be staying on this rock until the war is over."
The commander grabbed his helmet and ran out of the door, followed by the technician, in a series of resounding thuds from the boots of their armor. Indraat shook her head.
"Stupid colony. Useless planet. Damned humans."
Then she, too, bolted from the room toward her ship. Seated in the captain's chair with a bitter cup of tisane in a sealed container at her side to wash the taste of the planet out of her mouth, Indraat watched the atmosphere streak by. She waited for an extra minute for the stragglers, and all her forces were aboard the ships, headed for an altercation in space with their foes. As they broke out into vacuum, her troop transports set a course for the system exit point, furthest away from the enemy vessels, and her 4 cruisers flew at top speed to maximum weapons range, then began a circling pattern that would keep them in contact with the human vessels as they retreated. The electric tingle that heralded a battle in space crawled up from her lower spine, arriving in her skull as a sensation pleasurable enough to draw a relaxing exhalation from her lungs. She rolled her neck and waited.
"Shall I summon our reserve ships, Fleet Captain?"
asked her first.
"Negative," she replied.
"It looks like we can exit the system with minimal risk, and our work here is done. Let the reserve ships go where they can make a difference."
"Could they not make a difference in eliminating these humans, Fleet Captain?"
Indraat's eyes widened at the back of her first's head.
"Certainly they could, Kreena. But then we'd be succumbing to the same trap we've drawn our enemy into. Delay doesn't serve the Shoshin people, no matter how personally satisfying it would be."
"Yes, Fleet Captain."
Indraat had previously put her first's pointed comments down to the woman's understandable frustration at not having a command of her own. Now, though, she'd wondered if she'd been too generous in her assessment. The woman warranted watching. She gazed sideways to where her religious officer sat, strapped in at one of the bridge stations. His eyes widened slightly and darted toward the first's back, and she gave a slow blink of acknowledgement. She turned to the main display and refocused.
"Of course, there's nothing that says we can't draw some blood before we go."
She marked one of the human ships as a target.
"When the transports leave the system, we'll all attack the ship. Set it up," she commanded.
Several minutes later, the Droshin ships broke their pattern and formed a diamond shape, the rearmost of the 4 slightly higher than the ones ahead of it. They swooped in like a pack of hunting raptors and battered the human vessel with missiles and energy. The Ruby Rain, as the 4th ship in the line, claimed the kill with a final blast of its aft cannons. The Droshin ships ran from the furious humans, always just a meter out of range, and caught the gravity wave moments before their foes' weapons could catch them.
"I'll be in my quarters. Second, you have the bridge."
She enjoyed the stiffening in her first's shoulders as much as she enjoyed the pleased response from her subordinate.
"Yes, Fleet Captain. Thank you."
Alone in her cabin, the door secured against all except Deacon Ranja, Indraat stripped and washed the insidious crud of the planet from her body. The shower scalded her skin as she accepted the pain to increase her focus. She finished, toweled off, and shook her feathers dry before binding those on her skull back into a regulation arrangement. She donned her dress uniform and stood before the video pickup built into the display.
"Begin recording. Emperor Krada Tok. This is Fleet Captain Indraat Vray, reporting as ordered. Our assault on the human colony in Sector Quarine 7 was a complete success. All humans on the planet were eradicated."
She carefully kept her expression neutral as she engaged in the small deception.
We recovered data that spoke of a human response force and were forced to leave the planet when 8 ships arrived. As you know, this is double the number we anticipated, which suggests they've chosen an unexpected response to our provocation. I'm sure this wasn't an error in our planning, but rather another example of the random nature of our enemy.
She swallowed and pushed down the fear she might have just condemned a strategist on the home world to death with her report.
We're proceeding to our next target.
Indrot paused, looking down at her toes, then faced the camera again.
Uncle, I'm concerned that the response by the humans may necessitate a change in our approach. It's possible they found a way to counter our moves and potentially turn our traps back upon us. From my admittedly limited perspective on the front line, continuing with caution seems indicated.
She stiffened her back and lifted her chin.
Fleet Captain Indrot Frey, out.
The recording designator light faded away, and Indrot fell back on her bed with a troubled sigh. The Emperor's desire for visual communication made reporting anything other than complete success a test of one's ability to control expressions and body language. She was sure the worries she felt about the process of the war were normal for someone in her position. She was sure of it, wasn't she? Chapter 14. It felt strange to be back in his cathedral. Security concerns had forced him to move his residence to the palace, and the same security concerns prevented him from delivering his address each 8th day from any location less secure than the palace balcony. Even that had been outfitted with an invisible shield that would protect him from a sniper's bullet. Crata watched through the spy hole as one of his attendants warmed up his audience. The 8 priests who served him were now constantly on call rather than spending only a single day of each week in service. It was appropriate for his new role as both hierarch and emperor. His mind flashed back to the many times he'd stood before the spy hole, to the many times he'd held the god's inspiration on the tip of his tongue, struggling to contain himself until the moment arrived in the ceremony to share their words with his followers. Those days were long past. Now his sermons were as strategic as they were inspired, and the gods left the content up to him. Unquestionably, this was a sign of their confidence in him, their appointed vessel in the mortal realm.
"Is everything ready?"
he asked in a soft voice meant only for the ears of Chani, who stood nearby.
"Yes, Emperor," answered his seneschal. "And Varen?"
"Ready also, Your Grace."
"Very well,"
he said, and stepped back from the viewport to take a position in front of the doors. His attendant finished the preparatory prayer, and 2 others slammed the portal open before him. He strode into the cathedral, his cathedral, under the watchful gaze of the 8 and the hard stares of his congregation.
"Brothers and sisters," he began, striding to the center aisle.
He paused a moment to spear his attendant, who was leaving for the room far more slowly than necessary, with a sharp glance that increased his pace. He turned and faced the crowd, raising his arms as if to embrace them.
"It is right and good to spend the 8th day in worship of our gods. It is right and good that we should gather today in the cathedral. It is right and good that you have done so, to hear the words of the gods above and their chosen one below."
Crata sensed a ripple of discomfort spreading from his invocation, almost visible to the eye, and bared his teeth. He walked in silence down the center aisle, each step its own slow beginning and ending. The stares were heavy on his back as his congregation regarded his ceremonial vestments, a new design created just for this day. They were the black of the blackest diamond, and they absorbed the light like a black hole. The robes appeared to expel the trapped brilliance through the golden insignia woven into the front, the rear, and down each sleeve. the symbol of each god shown in the darkened cathedral, a display intended to capture the attention of his congregants. A shiver of discomfort rose from the crowd again as they realized these weren't the familiar icons they'd long known. Instead, these divine symbols harkened back to a less civilized time of the Zhou-Xin culture, a harsher, less forgiving time, a bloodier time, when the church claimed ascendancy through both words and force. After what felt like an appropriate interval, he spoke again.
"Today I'd like to speak of faithfulness to the gods. It's our one true purpose, to bring the gods' desires to reality in the mortal realm. It's not only the most important thing, it's everything."
Kratos spun on his heels, then began the return trek to the front of the cathedral. His stride filled with energy and confidence, his arms punctuated his sermon as he spoke.
"Faithfulness in words, of course, almost all of us offer. Faithfulness in the easy actions, such as joining together in celebration on the holy day, a fewer number offer. Faithfulness to the gods' mandates as we go about our lives, fewer still. But true faithfulness, the obedience that manifests in every decision of every day, this is what the gods demand. And this is what so few of you offer to them."
He reached the front of the room and walked up the small steps to the platform. He turned to face his audience again.
"But let us speak of yet another kind of faithfulness. Faithfulness to your mortal leaders as chosen by the gods."
He saw the expected frowns at the shift in subject.
"For the first time in generations, the Zhou-Xin religious, military, and political leadership are invested in one individual."
He glared at them. Unable to contain the passion, the anger, he yelled.
"The leader chosen by the gods as their avatar in the mortal realm."
Kratta pointed randomly at members of his audience.
"Some are unfaithful in their minds, doubting the gods' judgment, doubting the gods' words as provided through their chosen one."
He dropped his arm and raised the other to point at the other side of the church.
"Some are unfaithful in their words, speaking ill of their leaders, failing to show proper respect for the one the gods have set above them."
His voice dropped an octave, grew darker and raspier.
"Some are unfaithful in small deeds, who deliberately disobey, who gather when told not to gather, who shout slogans that damage our peace and unity."
He shoved his hands deeply into the pockets of his vestments to hide the trembling of his righteous fury. The cathedral echoed with the sound of his last words as they bled off to silence. Each congregant was aware something was coming, and he hoped each feared it would be targeted at them.
"And then there are those who are unfaithful in large deeds, who threaten the very fabric of our society with their selfishness. Those who dare to disrespect the gods, disrespect the Dadas Vajro, disrespect the church, the military, and the political leadership invested in the mortal avatar of the gods."
He glared at his audience and dropped his voice to a whisper.
"Unfaithfulness on any level cannot be tolerated. Witness the punishment for your transgressions."
He turned his head to the side and called,
"Bring in the traitor!"
The doors at the side of the room banged open, and two of the cathedral guards dragged a struggling man between them. He was clad in the uniform of a sub-commander in the Planetary Defense Center. They threw him to the ground at the base of the stairs in front of Kratta.
"This man, this filth," he hissed, "was overheard attempting to foment a coup."
The being before him struggled and tried to speak around the gag in his mouth. One of the guards kicked him to stillness. Crotta paused, letting the display sink into his audience.
Lack of faith will not be tolerated. It will instead be rewarded as the church of old rewarded traitors and unbelievers.
He turned and walked up to the altar, covered as always in a deep and luxurious mantle. He grabbed an edge and ripped it away, revealing the stone underneath, revealing the stains from centuries of sacrifices, revealing the channels that would carry the sacrifice's blood to a blessed chalice that awaited it. A newly placed light glowed, casting the altar in stark relief. The guards carried the writhing captive up to it and slammed him down atop the carved stone. His stunned form couldn't resist as they bound his hands and feet with manacles and shackles at the corners. Crotta turned to his congregation, pleasure surging through them at the looks of shock and fear on their faces.
You've forgotten the true meaning of what it means to be Zhroshin. You've forgotten the true meaning of service to the gods. You've forgotten your place. I pray to the Eight that this will remind you.
Varen entered the cathedral through a hidden door near the altar, bringing a sense of danger with her that swept over the congregation. He turned to regard her entrance. Her ceremonial black vestments were a more sumptuous version of her normal robes and cowl. They were adorned with black-on-black images of the gods' symbols. As she strode forward, she drew the long knife she wore in an ornamental scabbard at the small of her back and handed it to Crotta. He rotated back to his audience, the dagger balanced across his upturned palms as if he was offering it to the congregants.
This blade has a history, brethren. It was used for this purpose in the first cathedral ever built for the worship of our gods. It was used for centuries thereafter, until the worship of our holy ones took a gentler turn. It has slept, awaiting a need to pull it from its slumber.
Crotta's voice dropped, and it seemed as if the bones of the cathedral itself strained to hear his next words.
It's time for it to awaken. It's time for the church to again sacrifice the body and blood of the unfaithful to our gods in order to seek their approval and forgiveness for our many failings.
His face twisted into a vicious sneer.
After all, it is right and it is just that those who oppose their will in the mortal realm should get the opportunity to face their judgment without delay.
He turned and offered the dagger back to Varen. She took it and lifted it, positioned perfectly for the blade to catch the light and reflect it out to the congregation. She held it there, but for a moment, then pulled it down with a flourish, stalking to her position at the rear of the sacrificial altar. Crotta felt the rightness of the moment sweep through him and the approval of the Eight shining down on him. The ever-present pain in his skull vanished and was replaced by ecstasy.
Now, see what awaits the unfaithful!
He yelled, arms raised to the deities above. Varen lifted the blade and drove it down into the body on the altar. It transfixed the victim's heart, and blood flowed out from the matching wound in his back. His scream cut off as quickly as it started and echoed in the vast stillness of the chamber. The blood filled the chalice. Crotta walked to that end of the altar and looked down at the sacrifice, a vicious expression of satisfaction on his face. He lifted the chalice and turned as if to offer it to his congregation. The scent of the newly claimed blood and death suffused his nostrils, and he closed his eyes. He raised the chalice and drank. His ecstasy vanished in an instant as the vile taste coated his mouth and slipped down his throat. He stilled his features, set the chalice back into its receptacle, and made a stately exit from the cathedral to the horrified quiet of the congregation. Crotta Tuck most definitely did not sense the disapproval of the gods
communicated in the rancid blood of the victim. Definitely did not. Chapter 15. Cross entered the shuttle bay as soon as it depressurized, jogging toward the descending ramps of the two shuttles. The enemy's jamming had been overwhelming on this run, so only sporadic reports had made it back. He cringed when he saw one of the Marines, still clad in power armor but without a helmet, carried out on a stretcher. He rushed to the wounded figure and discovered Hugo Galano.
"Forget to dodge?"
The Marine laughed at him.
"Something like that. The suit tells me it's a clean break. He'll have me fixed up in no time. In the meantime, the painkillers are nice."
He dragged the last word out and drew a laugh from Cross. He patted the Marine's armor and got out of the way. Sinner stepped from the other shuttle, and the stench of mud and carbon and additional unpleasant things wafted from her. He tensed his face in an effort not to retch and said,
"Showers are over there."
She removed her helmet and shook out her sweaty hair.
"I thought desert planets were bad, but give me that over the disgusting jungle any time."
Saint emerged, his own helmet under his arm.
"No one said you had to swim in the stuff, Sin. That was not part of our mission parameters."
She made an obscene gesture in her counterpart's direction, then stomped off. Hopefully she'd hit a decontamination chamber first. He couldn't imagine that smell inundating the Marine's compartments. Cross turned to Saint.
"Details, Gunnery Sergeant?"
Saint checked to make sure all his troops were headed to where they were supposed to be, then turned back to reply.
"There were fewer of them than on the last two, but we definitely missed having the Pandora there. Fortunately, the AAN fighters harassed the enemy ships until we could turn it into a loss for their ground forces. They chose to board their transports and run away rather than finish the fight."
"And the colonists?"
"Some casualties among those who fought alongside us. Those who didn't were safe in a bunker at the center of the installation."
"Seems like the admirals did a good job of picking the order of colony defense, then."
Saint nodded, and Cross saw the moment the adrenaline left him. The suit suddenly appeared to be holding him up, rather than the other way around.
"In any case, you once again defended the defenseless and upheld the honor of the Washington. Thank you."
The Marine gave him a small smile and said,
"You're welcome, Captain."
Cross gestured him toward the exit, and Saint clomped off. As he watched the Marines progress from the bay, he had a moment of introspection, looking back at his earliest encounters with the gunnery sergeant. For the first time, he realized, in addition to being a complete bastard, Saint had been providing important lessons that he'd internalized without realizing it.
"Clever," he said out loud, then shook his head.
As he walked the corridors on the way to engineering, Cross trailed his fingers along the peeling paint on the walls. Even here, deep in the ship, they were uneven and full of hasty patches and ugly welds. The Washington had seen better days, but she still kept fighting the good fight. He recalled for a second the scent of newness that hung about the Chicago. It couldn't compare to the lived-in odors of the Washington, a mix of sweat, polish, and the pungent tang of new metal. He shook his head again, this time in quiet thanks for the opportunity to command her. His footsteps had brought him to engineering without his notice. The cacophony of the space's barely controlled chaos grew in his ears, and he searched around for the chief engineer. He found him in his office, with feet up on a display table and a tumbler of whiskey in front of him.
"Chief," Cross said as he plopped down into a chair beside Janik.
"Cross,"
the older man replied, pulling out a second glass and filling it with a finger of the amber liquid before sliding it over. He took a tiny sip, just enough to push the taste of the Marine's armor and the old corridors out of his mouth and nose, then returned it to the table.
"Got my junior watching things," Janik explained.
"I had nary a doubt, Chief."
They stared at each other for a second, then both broke into a chuckle.
I'm getting a little loose with the rules in my old age," Janik said.
"I have complete faith that you'll have it under control right until the instant the ship explodes underneath me."
"And rightly so," Janik countered. "So, status?" "You bent her again, Cross. This time in the other direction."
"I don't suppose you're going to tell me that the two cancel out?"
Thank the stars you didn't go into engineering, he said with a shake of his head.
No. What we have now are new points of tension throughout the ship, where the torque has misaligned the metal in sort of a wave, sparing you the molecular level discussion. Basically, she's more brittle than she was.
Cross frowned. How brittle? Janik scratched his chin, threw his beard, then folded his arms.
We might survive a hit from one of those rammers without breaking apart, but we'd likely no longer have the integrity to tunnel or use the wormhole network, if we could still fly at all.
Cross processed that information, then took another small sip of his drink, using the fiery burn to push away his darkest thoughts.
All right, then. No rammers. Got it. Torpedoes would be unwise, too,
Janik added with a surly grunt. Cross pushed down his annoyance.
Is it time, Chief?
Janik seemed to deflate before his eyes, the breath washing out of him in a long sigh.
Some moments it feels like it, my boy. Other moments? I know with complete certainty this is where I belong. Those moments are coming less often now.
Do you have any reports?
Janik shook his head.
The colony isn't on the list of those reporting attacks, so there has been no information. I'm sure she's fine. They're fine.
He didn't sound sure. Nothing available on the old engineers network, either?
Not a thing. Seems everyone's too busy trying to fix the damage of their vessels. That irksome captains keep causing.
Cross stood and gave Janik a soft punch in the shoulder as a goodbye. At the door, not looking back, he said,
The second you are sure, you tell me. There's still time to get you there before the big one.
He departed without waiting for a reply. The summons for the briefing came while he was en route to his quarters, so Cross switched paths and emerged onto the bridge. He waved at Jacobs to stay in the chair and strode to the ready room. He was a couple minutes early, so he took the opportunity to sink back into the padding of a seat. It was far from comfortable, but was the softest thing he'd felt in a while. He closed his eyes and stilled his thoughts, setting them free one by one until he was ready. He sat up, just in time for the activation of the main display. A grid of faces appeared, the captains of the ships currently undertaking colony defense and the available members of the Admiralty. Admiral Hugo Silva began speaking as soon as a connection was established.
Captains, you'll no doubt be pleased to know we have blunted the enemy's attacks on our colonies. While we've lost some, we have protected many, many more. Your efforts accomplished this, and you and your crews should be proud of them.
He coughed, then wiped his mouth and continued,
We've designated several ships to check out the remaining colonies and mop up whatever enemies are still around. A hunting pack, let's say. The rest of you should make your best speed to Sector 81, where we'll reform prior to our final assault. Our probes have shown a defensive buildup in the Zhoshin home system, which was to be expected while we addressed this delaying tactic. Nonetheless, the numbers still appear to be in our favor.
Unless it's a trap,
Cross whispered under his breath, followed by,
Of course it's a trap.
Silva continued speaking, and Cross refocused to catch the end of the sentence.
For refueling and rearming. Make whatever essential repairs are necessary where you are. Then get to the rally point.
The display shifted to show only the Admiral. He presumed the other captain saw the same.
Make no mistake. We will lose colonies by recommitting our final attack, unless we're incredibly lucky. But we cannot afford to delay any longer, lest we win the battles on the planets only to lose the war in space. See you all soon. Silva, out.
Cross strode onto the bridge.
Lee, how long to get to Sector 81?
1 day, 17 hours,
his helm officer replied after a moment of calculation.
Put it up on the screen, he said, raising a hand to keep Jacobs in the captain's chair.
When he saw the route and the planets along the way, The grin that covered his face made his muscles hurt. We're going to take a little detour. 11 hours and a number of minutes he didn't care to calculate later, Cross had reclaimed the captain's chair. A meal, 7 hours of sleep, a shower, and another meal had returned him to something very near human. He wore his dress blacks and had instructed the bridge officers to do the same. As they emerged from tunnel space and the system resolved itself before them, the door behind him hissed open. The chief engineer stepped onto the bridge, his accent pronounced as he said,
"Why have you torn me away from?"
His words trailed off as he took in the image on the main display, which shifted as they grew closer to their target.
"Launch drones,"
Cross commanded, and advanced sensor modules mounted on customized torpedoes blasted for the planet. The missiles shielded them from the atmosphere and ejected the drones once they reached visual distance to the ground. They deployed in separate directions, and the sensor officer put the take from one of them into a big window overlaid on the backdrop of the planet. Everyone was silent as the camera flew, showing them a luxurious landscape full of trees, lakes, and rivers that whipped by too fast to truly see. The sense of peace they engendered washed over the bridge like a wave. Finally, the drone decelerated, providing a swooping view of cultivated fields and farm buildings, then the well-maintained center of the human presence on the planet, Colony Wheaton. On the screen, colonists went about their day untroubled by the war, sweeping wide swathes of the galaxy.
"Fitzpatrick," Cross said softly.
And moments later, a ruggedly handsome man, with a shock of receding white hair and rivulets of wrinkles flowing down his face, appeared on the main display.
"Hail, Washington. What can we do for you on this fine day?"
His cheerful greeting seemed natural, but the tenseness at the corner of his eyes spoke to his worry.
"Routine check-in, Mayor Hidalgo. Do you have anything to report? Any problems?"
The man scratched the back of his neck.
"Well, we've had a few newborn children since our last official report. What was it? 5 months ago, but nothing more."
Cross glanced at Janik. His eyes were glued to the images on the screen, and he leaned forward as if eager to get closer to the planet.
"And your facilities? Everything is running smoothly?"
The mayor laughed.
"Our engineer would scare the misbehavior out of any machine, Captain."
Cross gave Hidalgo an answering smile.
"Very well then, Mayor. Lieutenant Fitzpatrick will provide you with direct communication codes to the Washington, D.C. If you find yourself in need, let us know."
"Will do, Captain. Thanks for stopping by,"
he said, and the signal dropped. The sound of the lift door opening and closing broke the silence, and Cross looked around at his bridge officers with a grin and saw matching expressions on their faces.
"All right, Lee. Head to the rendezvous. Top speed."
As he settled back in his chair, a one-to-one communication pinged in his earpiece, and his chief engineer's hoarse voice said only,
"Thank you, my boy."
Chapter 16. The door to her quarters slid aside in front of her, and Endrot entered. She turned and hit the appropriate sequence of buttons on the wall panel, so the room shifted to secure mode. Physical and electronic barriers snapped into place to shield her within her sanctuary, ready to defend against any enemy, or, in this case, to provide her with complete privacy as she accepted new orders from her home world. She stood, spine straight, and schooled her expression into one of neutrality. These days, she never knew who might be watching, even in a supposedly secure room.
"Playback message."
The ship's systems brought the display above her small table to life. The logo of the Zhroshin Navy rotated lazily to provide a visual counterpoint to the Emperor's voice as it emanated from the screen.
"Fleet Captain Endrot Vray, I send you greetings and congratulations on the successes your fleet has achieved. You've made manifest the will of the Zhroshin people and effectively delayed the human attack on the home world. The trespassers' forces are substantially depleted.
the attacks on the colonies were a complete success.
His breath rasped on an inhalation.
Now, however, is the time to begin a new strategy. The fleet is to finish its current attacks and return to the home system.